I ended up leaving because I realized that I couldn't be effective if I wasn't fully empowered. A paycheck is not worth that frustration. William told me I wouldn't be happy until I was running my own thing, but I ignored him and kept jumping from hustle to hustle. The travel and day jobs put a strain on my relationship with William because our schedules were diametrically opposed. Even with us living together, it was hard to find time. I worked when the sun was up, he when it was down, and that left little time for us to see each other. By the time he got home late at night, I was asleep and had to be up early to get the kids to school. I started to feel like he was checking out, and we chose to take a break in early summer. As we neared the fall, William and I got together to figure out what we were doing. He had planned the whole evening. We rode bikes down the FDR, around the bottom of the island, and up to a restaurant on the west side. It felt sweet and romantic, and I just knew he was going to tell me that his desire to be with me was stronger than the challenges we were facing at the time. We took pictures in the warm sunset, and it felt so good to lean into his body again. When we sat down to dinner, I told him how much I loved him and what I had learned from being with him. It took a second for him to respond. I thought he was trying to figure out how to say that he loved me like the moon loves the sun and that he decided that we should get married, just like we talked about. Instead, I got these 6 words. Being with you taught me patience. After I'd opened up to him in a moment of such uncertainty, his statement shot through me like a cold blade. I got up, leaned over the table, and said, "Put my keys in the mail." 6 words back. Quid pro quo. I got on a bike and rode home, hoping the whole way that he would chase me. But he wasn't that man, and this wasn't a rom-com. I got into bed, and in a fit of sadness and frustration, reached out to all the boys I'd been ignoring since getting together with William. I hadn't deleted all the phone numbers, and certainly not the emails. I needed to fill this hole, so to speak. About a week later, William came to get his stuff. Gathering all his clothes, folding them up neatly, and stacking them on my dining room table was a heartbreaking exercise. I felt numb. It was perfectly cordial, but that's highly imperfect and painful when you still love someone. When he hugged me goodbye, I thought, I'm smelling him for the last time. I'm feeling the gentle pressure of his strong hands on the small of my back for the last time. And I'm feeling the warm touch of his soft lips on my forehead for the last time. He walked out the door as he had done hundreds of times before, and I locked it behind him as I had done hundreds of times before. And in the minute that I knew that it would take the slow elevator to get to my floor, I hoped again for a Hollywood moment, for William to knock on the door, for me to open it, fall into his arms, for no words to be spoken. I stood by the dining room table, waiting to hear his footsteps come back to me. Even after I heard the elevator ding and the doors close, I thought he might come back. But he didn't. For the next couple of weeks, I had Sia's Chandelier on repeat. Not sure what the song meant to her, but for me, it was the promise to myself that I was going to live the fuck out of my life despite my heartbreak. For now, though, I would embrace my sadness. I sat in the bathtub, hugging my knees to my chest, hot water cascading over me, and belted out the lyrics to the song between breathless sobs. It would be several months before we spoke again, and it wasn't to wish each other Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, or Happy Birthday. A woman I had recently befriended in LA texted me while I was at the gym. She was hoping to get coffee and asked if I was still in town. "No, is everything okay?" I texted back. She responded with a cryptic text and asked if we could get dinner the next time I was in LA. Apparently, we had shared history that she seemed anxious to talk about. Shared history? Oh, you mean we fucked the same guy? I responded, "I don't give a fuck." This was a sophomoric conversation that could not be less interesting, particularly since I didn't know her like that. I continued my workout, but something stopped me mid-kick and my step faltered. Fuck. What if it's William? My mind started racing at a velocity and in a direction that only begat dread. He had spent a lot of time in LA. They were both in music. They could have easily found themselves in the same rooms. I took a deep breath and typed the next words. Who was it? It seemed like it took her an eternity to respond. I could barely breathe. When I finally got the response, I felt a sense of relief the likes of which I don't recall feeling in years. Our shared history was Derek, the actor. I thought about it later and decided I wanted to talk to William about it. He called me back the next day. Again, I was at the gym doing kung fu. "Hey, thanks for calling," I said. "Are you at the gym?" "Yes." "I still know your schedule, Sophia." That simple statement already started to break me down. I was calling because I had an interesting experience. When I got to the point in the story where I asked her who it was, he said, "Who was it?" I could hear him smiling. "It wasn't you." But he knew that before I even answered. "Sophia, I told you when I was with you that I was never with anyone else. Neither was I, but William, it made me realize that I would be really upset if I saw you again. So I wanted to make a deal with you. Since it's likely that we'll end up in the same room, can we please do each other the courtesy of warning the other if we think that's a possibility? Especially if we're going to be there with a date? Well, that won't be necessary because I moved to Cali. I couldn't stand the thought of running into you on the east side." And boom, there it was. I started to cry. Leaning on the rolling metal box that housed the gym stereo, I watched as my tears dropped onto my phone. "Oh, you did? When?" My voice was breaking. "Not long after we broke up." "Oh. How are the kids?" "You know what, William? I'm not ready for this. I can't do small talk with you. It's too painful to hear your voice." "Okay, Sophia. Take care." "You too." I hung up the phone and thought about Chris. Until that moment, I had only ever thought about how the grief for someone who's passed away can blindside you. But this exchange showed me that the loss of love can lurk in the corners of my heart, which, thank God, still beats with ferocity and abandon. Even though it was clear that I still loved William, I didn't allow myself to wallow in sadness and linger in the past. It's not in my nature, and it's a luxury that single mothers simply don't have. The kids were now 14 and 16, on the express train to college. I told Jin Long after we'd visited schools that I didn't want him to feel pressured to get into one. I wanted him to see what was out there. When it came time for him to apply to colleges, I got really stressed out because he didn't seem to feel the urgency as much as I did. I never insisted that my kids get straight A's, but I wanted more than anything for them to live up to their potential, which I didn't think Jin Long was doing. I didn't know what to do because he didn't want my help. I called my girlfriend Nikki, whose son is 15 days younger than Jin Long and one of his closest friends, and she one of mine. "Sophia, let him do it himself," she said. "Our sons are about to be 18. It's time that we let them grow up. I moved here from Korea by myself at 15. They should be able to do their own college applications. Let him go, and I'm sure he'll surprise you." This was one of the most difficult lessons in faith that I had encountered. I am a manager and a producer by nature. Taking care of every aspect of a business or project is in my blood, so walking away from the biggest step in my son's life to date was so incredibly difficult. But Nikki had never steered me wrong, so I did as she said. I let go. As a result, with the exception of filling out the financial aid forms, which are such a pain in the ass, Jin Long applied to almost 20 schools on his own. When the first acceptance letter came, he texted me a picture of the email and wrote,
"I couldn't have done it without you, Mom."
Colleges also became a major part of my life, and I went back to school in a way. Adam Mitchell, an MIT student who had heard my microphone check interview with Ali Shaheed Muhammad and Franny Kelly, invited me to come speak. I did my first lecture there in the fall of 2016 and loved it. The room was filled with young, eager minds, mostly children of immigrants from Asia and South Asia. Speaking to and engaging with them told me that once and for all, this is what I was meant to do. I came back to Boston a couple months later and spoke at a number of other schools. When I shared my vision with my friends, they all told me that I had to write a book in order to secure bigger speaking gigs. I told myself again that I could write while working. In the spring of 2016, I started running Pro Era Records for my dear friend Joey Badass, the Brooklyn hip-hop artist. I told him I would do it as long as I was simultaneously working on my book. After 5 months, it became apparent that I couldn't maintain the balance between work and writing. Running a small label was something I could do in my sleep, whereas writing was a Herculean task. I knew I had to stop taking jobs in order to commit myself to the book, and it took every immigrant iota of willpower to walk away from a steady paycheck. Meanwhile, this whole time that I wasn't making a steady paycheck, I never told my mother, and I said to Hesog, "Don't tell Mom." He's like,
"I would never tell Mom that."
Joey and I met in Bryant Park to discuss my resignation. It was a beautiful, warm, sunny Friday afternoon, the kind that makes you fall back in love with New York and forgive her her myriad sins. I sat waiting for him at one of the metal tables on the south side of the park. I looked around at the people and the beautiful hustle and bustle of the city I call home. I saw Joey bounding across the street, his dreads bobbing high atop his tall, lithe frame. We hugged, and when we sat down, I said, "Joey, I love you and the guys, and I love this job, but I can't stay. I told you when I started that I would only do the gig as long as I was still writing. Unfortunately, my book became my side piece."
"I love you too, Soph, and I understand. You told all of us that. I'm just sorry that it has to end now."
"How long do you want me to stay?" I asked, almost hoping he'd say a number of months.
"Soph, if you give me 2 weeks..."
I panicked slightly. "Do you think that's enough?" I didn't want things to fall apart and took the quick turnaround personally. Maybe he didn't think I was important enough to the organization. "I can give you till the end of the year if you want." He placed his right fingertips down gingerly on the table, his hand and wrist raised high above them.
"I can't cage you, Soph. You're a butterfly. You need to be free."
I knew he was right. I am a free spirit who needs to fly toward her destination, unknown though it may be. It wasn't that he didn't value my work. It was that he valued my dreams more than his utility. In short, Joey loved me enough to let me go. Around this time, Joan texted me a flyer from NYU where William would be lecturing the next day. It was kind of hard for me to look at it, but I was happy he was lecturing. I knew he'd be great at it. The next day, I thought of him as I rode a bike past his place on the way to the dentist. On the way home, as I rode down the FDR, I saw him running toward me. We both slowed down and stopped at a bench. "I talked you into existence," he said. "I was just running down the FDR by your place and thought I should take a left and come see you. You were always witchy that way." This conversation didn't feel like the last one. It was easier, but I barely looked him in the eye. We engaged in small talk and he told me about his lecture. For some stupid reason, I acted like I didn't know. "I'm DJing on Saturday night if you want to come by." "I'd rather fuck you than see you in public, William." "Ah," she opens the door. This might sound counterintuitive, but it had been a full year since we'd broken up, and I felt I had enough emotional distance to engage with him again. And I really missed fucking him. "We can make that happen," he answered, boldly stepping toward me, pulling me in close, and clapping his right hand firmly on my ass. I went home, exhilarated and nervous. As Joan would say,
"Well, Soph, I think you've got to stop asking for shit because you keep getting it."
I called her and Michelle, and they cautioned me against seeing him. I wasn't sure if they were right, but I knew I wanted to see him, to feel him inside of me again, to experience once more that unique connection that intersected with love, respect, and sexual chemistry. When he walked in the door late that night, he looked around and commented on everything that had changed in the apartment. Then we went straight to the bedroom. He took a shower, as he always did before he got into my bed, and climbed under the covers, naked. Je frissonnais de désir. I was shuddering with desire. The second he kissed me lightly and pulled me into him, the months that had separated us melted away. He remembered every inch of my body, inside and out, and I his. Jen Hong once told me she was sad because she had no memories of her father and me happy together. That's some hard shit to hear. But I got to offer my children an example of a healthy, loving partnership with William. I am grateful for the 2.5 glorious years we spent loving each other. William and I still see each other when he's in New York or I'm in Cali. We catch up, have amazing sex, and don't talk in between. I don't want to be with him anymore, and I'm pretty sure he feels the same. I never thought I'd be able to do this, but it's part of maturing. Eventually, each of us will fall in love with someone else and will be truly happy for the other. I find myself again wondering what the next man will look like. What I am certain of is that he will have to know how to take care of me like William did. I still feel his hands and hear his words, and those are gifts. His gentle pushes to get me to write helped me to arrive at the keyboard where I wrote this memoir. By 2018, I would have an agent and an audiobook deal. But that wasn't even the most monumental event of the year. By then, it had become clear that we needed to move my mother out of our childhood home. It was a modest 2,500 square feet, but three floors, and it was nerve-wracking for us to think of our mother navigating those stairs alone. She started to get scared by the noises the old house would make at night. Since my father's death, we had talked about moving her into a condo, but Hesog suggested assisted living, seeing as she would eventually end up in such a facility. She was 85 when we started the conversation. Better to move once than twice, and better to do it, as her doctor said, when she could, as opposed to when she had to. Because he was on an academic schedule, Hesog was able to spend months at a time in Vancouver with our mother and took her to see some facilities. My mother complained that the most upscale place one was too white, which I thought was fucking hilarious, and I hope due to my influence. We settled on a beautiful place on the UBC campus where she had spent decades of her life working. Moving my mother out of the house was one of the most challenging things I've ever done. Imagine moving 40 years of a family's life. Now imagine that the person who lives there is an Asian immigrant who has been through not one, but two wars. My mother never met a takeout container, jar, or plastic bag that she didn't deem worthy of keeping. I have to resist doing it myself. Then there was the nice stuff that we never used, the good plates and cutlery. And how about the fancy cake service that Hesog and I had never seen, and she didn't even remember that he found above the fridge? We gave a bunch of stuff away to friends and donated the rest. It took countless garbage bags and trips to Goodwill. I am grateful, however, that my mother kept every one of my report cards. One summer when I wasn't in Vancouver, Hesog showed my high school report cards to my kids and said,
"If your mother ever nags you about your grades, tell her you've seen these."
They thought that was the funniest shit in the world, and the three of them laugh about it to this day. I was a B average student, and most of the comments were along the lines of, "Sophia talks too much in class." I spent the first few days of cleaning out the house seething with anger because I had been saying since my father passed that we should start getting rid of stuff. It had never been so tense between my mother and me, and that includes when I was a teenager. I was so angry and judgmental of every little useless thing she wanted to keep, which, in retrospect, was rude and insensitive. At one point, I called my girlfriend Tanya and told her I couldn't take my mother anymore. I wanted to leave. She said, "Soph, your mother is 85, and she's moving her whole life into a new place. Maybe you could have a little more patience." I said, "Fuck you, Tanya." Just kidding. Of course I stuck it out, but I had a really hard time letting go of my resentment. The emotional underpinning of all this, of course, was my mother's mortality, and by extension, my own. We were moving her into the house where she would live until she died. On top of all that, selling the house was extremely unnerving. The Vancouver housing market has long been considered the largest real estate bubble in the world, but by the time we decided to sell, the air was leaking out of that bubble. After waiting for months, we ended up selling below ask, but it was still exponentially more than what my folks had paid for it 40 years prior. When I told my friends that we had moved my mother, they said we were lucky that she went willingly. I asked Hesog recently, "Do you think Mom is happy?"
I don't know how to answer that question, and I don't think she'd know how to answer that question.
I don't think my parents ever thought about their happiness. Their lives were such a struggle from the gate, and once they made the big move to Vancouver, it was all about providing for their children. They gave me the extravagance of pondering and seeking my happiness daily. of finding my passion and pursuing it throughout my whole life. I never wondered if they were happy. I never asked who they were as people beyond being my parents. I knew what they enjoyed and disliked, but never asked them about their dreams, their disappointments, their internal lives. My mother and father survived two wars and emerged champions. I can only hope to embody a small part of their grit, courage, and unyielding belief that on the other side of today's difficulty, there is a better tomorrow. Shout out to Jeonwoo. After almost drowning, being caught by the North Korean police, escaping the Japanese, almost freezing to death, which my father described as the most pleasant sensation right before you're about to die, and being closely acquainted with misery and death, they managed to live happy, beautiful lives full of fun, laughter, music, food, family, and friends. Just a couple of months after we moved my mother, Jinlong was off to college. That spring, I went with Jen Hong and Hee-seok to attend the ceremony for an academic award he had received for his first term. I was so proud. As we pulled up to the front of the campus, I turned my head and looked at the large green lawn, the fountains, and the 70s modern architecture. It suddenly struck me that this was Jinlong's home now. I said quietly, "I can't believe my son lives here." I had to get out of the car because my tears were choking me. I took deep breaths and calmed myself down. I didn't want him to have to greet me as I wept. When we sat down at the Korean restaurant that Jinlong had picked out, I asked him to sit right next to me. I hugged him and buried my face in his back. I could not stop crying. I watched as he and Jen Hong laughed and talked and teased each other like the best friends they are. One of the silver linings of separating from Yan Ming was that it drew my kids closer together. Jinlong has protected his little sister from the day she was born when he brought her the red teddy bear at the hospital. Once, when they were very young, I yelled at Jen Hong for something and told her she couldn't have any chocolate. Jinlong promptly took her into the room where he shared his chocolate with her. That's my son. Jen Hong is more like her mother. She is articulate, curious, focused, disciplined, competitive, and mature beyond her years. She has a hot temper and a mean streak. But my children are both kind, just, sensitive, progressive, outspoken, defenders of underdogs, funny, and so, so much smarter than their mother. In short, they're good people, and that's the best gift I can offer the world. Through all of these seismic shifts, I was writing about my ever-fluctuating life. It sounds daunting, but the support of my friends and the almighty love of our small family saw me through every step. Epilogue. All eyes on me. On New Year's Day 2018, I posted a video proclaiming that I was the baddest bitch in the room and listed the reasons why. It was liberating and empowering to put it out there. No shame, no apologies, no caveats. The concept of the baddest bitch in the room came to me a decade prior when I attended the second annual Black Girls Rock Awards show. The organization was founded by DJ-turned-philanthropist Beverly Bond to celebrate and empower magical Black girls. That night, I was in the company of three such exceptional creatures, Beth Ann Hardison, Joan, and Sam Martin, my friend at HBO who had bought my screenplay. When we left the event, I ran down the stairs in front of the others to capture a picture of those three women gliding down the staircase like royalty. Beth Ann with her closely cropped salt-and-pepper hair, wearing a brightly colored African print dress. Joan in a sage raw silk empire waist dress. And Sam in an Alberta Ferretti black Italian widow-length dress. As I took photo after photo after photo, it occurred to me that my girls were the baddest bitches in the room. Now that may sound competitive, but it isn't. It's not about looking antagonistically at other women, but about claiming our power and beauty as women who are almost exclusively of color and over 40 in a world where we are given little to no indication that we are powerful and beautiful. We come from different walks of life and are all feminists who stand in tenacious opposition to patriarchy and white supremacy. There could be prettier, richer, more accomplished women in the room, but those aren't the qualities that grant membership into the baddest bitch club. It's the extraordinary aggregate of our strengths that constitutes our power. And part of being the baddest bitch in the room is owning it. If you truly believe it, that energy emanates when you walk into a room. My hope is that someday every woman will feel as mightily about herself as we do. I enter every space like I'm 6 feet tall. I am heightened by my confidence, desire to stand out, and unique style, which I've spent a lifetime honing as a response to feeling invisible. I am aware of the genetic privilege I enjoy, my father's razor-sharp cheekbones and my mother's hummingbird metabolism, and I know that this playing field is not level, and that beauty is capital, as Joan would say. As a woman, I use every tool in my arsenal to get my foot in the door and a seat at the table. But here's the hitch. Once I'm there, my goal is to have everyone saying, "Fuck, she's smart," as opposed to, "Damn, she's hot." The one exception is in my first meeting with Tupac, I was wearing a short skirt and my legs were bare. And he was sitting directly across from me. And at one point, somebody asked him a question. He just kind of leaned back and looked under the table and said, "I have no idea what you just asked me. The only thing I'm going to remember from this meeting is that Sophia's got great legs." I'll take that. Pac gets a pass. Furthermore, I haven't kicked down doors to let them close behind me. I keep them open and bring my folks in with me. Because that's how we do. Many men have told me that they were initially scared to talk to me. Well, they should be. My confidence serves as a filter. If you're too shook to approach me or think I'm out of your league, you're probably right, because you lost the second you doubted yourself. Having been the little Asian girl who was bullied, I delight in the idea that I scare people. And if you had told the scrawny 10-year-old girl who was embarrassed to do push-ups in front of her gym class that she would be considered physically formidable at 54, she would have called you crazy. I am stronger than I've ever been in my life. My body is my temple. I keep it fit and clear of toxins, physical and emotional. My fitness is paramount to my well-being. I'm hardly suggesting that others go to the same lengths as I have to get in shape. I know I'm fortunate to have a flexible schedule that allows for extensive time at the gym. When my friends ask about working out, I tell them to just establish a routine, whatever it is. Treadmill, yoga, a walk in the park. I've reached the point where training is as integral a part of my life as eating and sleeping, such that it's harder not to do it than to do it. I have to take care of myself so that I'm in the best shape possible for my kids and the others in my life for whom I wage tiny battles every day. People talk about second acts in life, and I feel fortunate that I've had many, from music to kung fu to motherhood and marriage, back to music to film and TV and now writing and public speaking. My path, though unpredictable, is a reflection of my never-ending pursuit of self, to discover what it means to be Sophia Chang. A woman, Asian, a mother, a lover, a friend, a hustler. But I didn't get here on my own. It took a motherfucking village to raise Sophia Chang. My ride or die stand by me when I'm faltering, embrace me when I'm hurting, toss me onto their shoulders when I'm celebrating, talk me off the ledge when I'm about to lose my shit, and pull me aside when I'm fucking up. They are my pillars, my shields, and my mirrors, who challenge me every day to be a better person. I couldn't do what I do without them. And then there's the clan, who provided me with life-changing firsts. Method Man was the first to call me family. Old Dirty Bastard was the first to hire me as a manager. And RZA was the first to empower me as a general manager. They weren't a constant physical presence over the last quarter century, but they didn't need to be, because they're with me everywhere I go. Wu-Tang helped me find my voice and led me to Yan Ming. Method Man gently tended to my confidence as a middle-aged woman. What I am categorically certain of right now is that it's my turn. After decades of helping extraordinarily talented men tell their stories, I realize it took me so long to tell my own because I believed myself smaller and less important, that my role was limited to support. Well, the butterfly has emerged from her cocoon, and is spreading her wings. What I am asking of the world is simply to imagine that I exist. My very being is an act of defiance. I am an Asian, middle-aged, single mother of two teenagers who is out here raising hell, pounding her fists on the table, and fucking with abandon. I am not allowing the dominant culture to tell me who I am. I am defining myself and telling the world who I am. In other words, fuck your model minority. I'd like to shout out every kid in school who made fun of my parents' names, turned their noses up at our food, or saying, Chinese, Japanese, dirty knees, look at these, to my face. To anyone who ever asked, is your pussy sideways? Can you see when you smile? Are you a tiger mom? And to every man who ever greeted me with konnichiwa, or ni hao, or told me he had an Asian girlfriend. Like I give a fuck. Understand that each of those microaggressions added another plate to my suit of armor and created this warrior who is impervious to your bullshit bigotry. Every chink spat my way, prompted me to crush the box. Every jab propelled me to pursue my passion. Every gook pushed me to tell my story. Know this, your small-mindedness fuels my prodigiousness. Your ignorance, my wisdom. Your weakness, my power. And lastly, a shout out to the fly girls who wake up each morning, look in the mirror, and say, I may not be tall, thin, young, and blonde, but goddamn if you don't walk out that door feeling sexy, beautiful, and powerful. To all the women warriors who go to work every day, and despite making less on the dollar, getting talked over by their male peers, being overlooked for a promotion in favor of a mediocre man, still give it 150%, because that's what the fuck we do. And finally, to all the mothers, especially the single ones, who cook, clean, hustle, and love the shit out of your kids. I feel more powerful than I've ever felt in my life, and I'm only getting stronger. Look, it took me years, miles, blood, sweat, and tears to get here, but the air is so clear at the top of this peak. I feel like nothing clouds my view. No one can stand in my way. And most importantly, I have myself sharply in focus and want the world to see me too. You may not like what you see, but you will see me, motherfucker. It's time for me to step in the arena, bring the noise, and raise the ruckus. So guard your grills, because I'm ready for my close-up. My name is Sophia Chang, and I'm the baddest bitch in the room. Hello, dear listener. Well, you've made it to the bonus content round. Thank you for listening to just over 7.5 hours of me telling my story. I hope you enjoyed it. And now this is your little gift. This is where you get to hear the process of me recording with my family and my friends. And I hope it gives you an insight into what that was like, but also into the relationships that I have with these fine people. Some of it will make you laugh, and some of it is probably going to make you cry. Enjoy.
One day, Jiang Hong...
What's your name again?
Bro, why do we look at each other?
Sorry.
Mommy, I'm glad you did what you did. It taught me that I need to stand up for myself.
You're the best mommy in the world. Go ahead.
Lying is a sin. Do you want to go for pizza tomorrow night, Mommy? I'll pay.
So put a little more... Think about it, like I'm in front of you crying, right? Like,
what can we do, Mommy? You already do so much.
What are you saying, you didn't care?
I only saw you cry twice in my life. One time, remember I was taking a bath when I was young and I was scooping out the water? I got mad and I just went like this and I scooped out all the water. And I remember you were crying and you had a cole.
I don't remember.
Good, I'm so glad you don't remember that. So good, forget that.
I don't remember.
The other time was when I came home and you were in the basement and you had my birth control pills.
Did I?
Yeah.
Did I? Don't know. Did I?
Yeah. Traumatized.
Dead me. I.
And you knew what that was, girl?
Yeah.
So, Mom. So I want you to say, I just want you to have a good life. Because, so this is what I say. The second was when I came home at around 18 and found her in my basement by herself crying. I asked her what was wrong, and she opened her hands to show me that she had discovered my birth control pills.
I
don't remember.
I don't remember.
And you said, I just want you to have a good life.
No need to worry. We've got Sophia. She's the glue.
Elmer's.
No need to worry. We've got Sophia. She's the glue.
Super. Is it super?
No need to worry. We've got Sophia. She's the glue.
Gorilla.
Minty paste that we used to eat in school. Do you remember those little tubs?
Oh, yeah. I used to eat that stuff. In a world of hip-hop madness. Okay. No.
No weed.
No weed. No weed, no worry. Sophia's got weed. No,
Sophia's got weed. She's got edibles.
Michael tilted his head down and studied me intently with his clear blue eyes over his wire-framed glasses.
Green eyes.
Green eyes. Wire-framed glasses.
How is she doing on me? It's just like...
A few seconds of nerve-wracking silence elapsed. Damn, I fucked up. And then he said...
Yes, that's exactly it, Sophia.
So this is exactly...
What would I do without you, Sophia?
For, really, like... He thanked me for every award he received.
Where have you been my whole life? Wife's inspiration taught me everything I know.
But my favorite house guest by far was Redman. AKA Reggie Noble.
Okay.
I met Regman, as I called him, at a Too Short album release party in 1990. He was rocking an oversized North Face down jacket and what he called his, you're going to say drug dealer bracelet, and had a tissue hanging out of his nose. I fell in love with him immediately. Who goes out with the tissue hanging out of their nose?
I'm sorry.
Redman.
Redman.
He clearly did not give a fuck. He had terrible allergies and was always congested. He was living on Long Island with Eric Sermon of EPMD and was often in the city, late at the studio or doing God knows what. If he didn't want to drive home, he would just come to Sophie's. He was more like a boarder than a guest. He would come by my place at all hours of the night and yell out to my window, and that's when you'd say Sophie.
Sophie, open the door!
God damn it.
Oh, God damn it.
He ended every sentence with God damn it. Uh-huh. It was hardly like the romantic yearning of John Cusack and Say Anything, more like...
I need to take a shit!
I would open the window and throw the keys down, and he would come upstairs and crawl up into the smaller loft and knock out.
Mm-hmm.
There was no small talk. No, how was your night? How's work? Nada. But watching him jam into that tiny space was worth being woken up at 3 a.m. The opening was only about 4 feet square. Reggie is 6'1", and when I met him, kind of chunky. Nothing like the lean machine he is now, and he would inevitably be wearing his puffy black North Face.
That's right.
It was like seeing a super fluffy chow chow squeezed through a doggy door. Oh my god, I love you. Okay.
I think I got you.
Oh, yep. Here.
I'm ready. I am so ready.
I am so grateful. Don't go, don't go.
Yeah?
Don't go. Are you texting a girl right now?
No, I ain't texting no girl. I'm just trying to.
Is he texting a girl right now?
I'm single. He ain't got no girls.
I'm still not texting no girl.
Really?
Texting fat ass Marky. Yeah.
Who's fat ass Marky?
My cousin that was on stage.
Mr. Cream? That's Mr. Cream.
Man, that's Sophia Chang, nigga. And she from Shaolin, alright? She down with the Wu-Tang. That's all you need to know about her. Fuck is you to ask her where she from? Fuck is you, man. Don't ever disrespect her again.
God damn it.
God damn it. Fuck wrong with these kids. I want to beat his lord ass that day.
To my surprise, and that of my poor unsuspecting fellow mass transit riders, Meth and Ghost lean way over the railing and roared,
if anybody fuck with you, Sophie, you tell them you with the Wu-Tang, because we'll fuck them up. That's if they come near you with they stinking asses.
God damn it.
So if it's not going to be easy for you to find a man because you're too hard, Raphael told me. What are you talking about? You're this little woman, but you have a huge personality. He's just like you. He said, this is Raphael Sadiq. You're this little woman, but have a huge personality. You boss people around and you're strong as shit.
Yeah,
that's right.
Pretty much.
Levels. Okay, good.
Got it. I know, straight.
My
recording. Pebbles.
Oh my god, I wasn't fucking recording.
Oh no, come on, Sophie.
Swear to god.
Fire.
Did you tape Doc?
No, I didn't get Doc.
You didn't get me, Sophie?
Oh my god, I can't believe it.
Oh, you know you fucking fire.
I'm so fired.
Are you sure you didn't get it?
You're so fired.
I'm so fired. I got
you.
Okay.
I got you.
Okay, well, we might as well just start from here. Because I got an earlier flight than everybody.
No, I do. I leave at 4:30.
I leave at 4.
Piece of shit.
Somebody asked me, well, you know, why did Wu-Tang take to you, right? And I said, I don't know. You know, I think about Ghost when I look back at it. I think about the hundreds and thousands of people that were around you guys. And they were all trying to get next to you. And for some reason, you guys just went, oh, okay. This one right here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And people were like, well, maybe it's because they respect you. And I said, they respected me, but they respected a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's because you were such a fan. And I said, look, there were lots of fans, and there were bigger fans than me. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe it's because, you know, and they named all their, you know, you can name a lot of reasons. And I said, but you know what? I can name a bunch of other people that they felt that way about. But there was something different between us. There was no sex. There was no money. Mm-hmm. There was no power. There was no access. In other words, it wasn't transactional that way, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not like, oh, well, Sophie's getting us these jobs, or she's so-and-so's girlfriend, or whatever. She was just like, she's here.
Yo, listen, that's what I just was telling you, that sometimes things just happen. You know what I mean? Where I put it all in the Most High's hands, when it just clicked. It just, boom, and it's like, you home. Like, I can't even really put it that much in words, but it's like I said, once we connected and spiritually, it's like, yo, you right there. Like, sometimes you can't explain it. And with other motherfuckers, it's like they might not have got that far, even though we know them. I met motherfuckers 25, 26 years ago, but like you said, you right here. You right here. Ain't no motherfuckers right there. I don't even talk to a lot, most of those motherfuckers. But It seemed like we just stayed together out of all these Edisons, 25. It just seemed like that's how it was supposed to be. Like, yo, just come in the house. All right, you hear that? All right, yeah. All right, cool. And that's it. Like, no questions asked. Like, it's just family. Like, you feel like family is like, yo, automatically we look out for each other. And that's it. Like, I don't even really know what else to fucking say. Because what you said, I can't go back to remembering, all right, when after I saw you the first time, what did we do the second time? I just know the first time, you was there all the time. That was it. Like, oh, hey, so what are you doing? Get it, you know what I mean? It just went. Like, after the first time, we was just there. Like, holy shit, now we here, 20 fucking 6 years later, on the fucking couch. It's like, yo, this is, this, and that's what it is. Like, everybody don't get that. And I don't, and everybody since back then, I don't think there's another person around that's like you that. That really like that we're close like that. Yeah, she yelled just like yo, boom. And it's like, yo, all right, family. It didn't always stay that way. And you never change. That's one thing about you. You never change. It's like you come in one way and you leave that way. Like every day, like you like a sunshine. You like sunshine. You know what I mean? Because I never really seen you come in nowhere with an attitude or super down. And stuff like that. Your energy always is the same energy. And I think that's why we love you like that so much. Like, because you only showed us one side. And if you was to ever show us another side, I know something is wrong. You know what I mean? Because we so used to seeing one side of you. Not two sides, just one. And it's a happy side. That's why I said it's a sunshine side.
Even if I didn't talk to you, knowing that you were there, right? That's still something for me.
Right.
You know, like, right. I still feel this.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you're not physically here, like, I can just close my eyes and, oh, you're right there. So you know, right. You know what that feels like because you've been there so many times.
Right.
And I can just imagine, like, okay, Ghost is standing right here, and I'm just going to close my eyes, and he's just going to hug me, and I can disappear into this place, right? After I do everything that I do, and I'm running things, and I'm pitbulling, and I'm negotiating and everything, and then I can just go, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm standing right here, and he's right here, and he just... That's an amazing feeling. It's the best feeling ever.
That's real shit.
To know that, to just always have, like...
I'll always be there for you. I don't give a fuck what it is. Like, you always been so good to me. You know what I mean? Since day one. So it's like, shit, any way that I can get ahead and give that same energy back, it's like, yo, it's whatever. Certain things you do for people do for you, it's like, yo, you just do it right back for them. That's a friend. Nah, so you know what it is and shit. Yeah, man. We love you, man. It's like, yeah, we love you and shit, dude.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Ray.
That was easy. I like how you doing that. That's what's up.
Gotta do it easy. Gotta make it easy.
I know you want a masterpiece this shit. I know that. I already know. You excited?
Oh my God.
That's right. So,
you know what, Ray? It's so amazing to be on the other side of it now. Right? Like, I'm the artist now. Excuse me.
That's great. And you've always been an artist, though, girl. You've just been a politician with it, though, too, though.
You think? I never thought of myself as an artist, right? I just thought of myself as, like, cogs and wheels.
Nah. I always knew you had that in you, though. You
really? Know what I
mean? Of course, yeah. So, really? You always had style, yo. And anything you did, you always finessed it. So, that ain't nothing new. What? You acting like that's new?
Really, Ray?
Yeah, that's nothing new. You've been a master at what you do. Come on.
I just saw myself, you know, Ray, as like, that's the person that'll just get it done. You know, like,
nah.
Go buy the blunts and the black and tans at the deli. Somebody asked me, so now that you've written your memoir, what's the question you're left with? And the question I was left with, Ray, was, why me? Meaning, when I think about, I was just like a Korean girl, you know, from Vancouver, and you guys didn't know anything about me. I was just like I wasn't sleeping with you. You know what I'm saying? There was no money. There was no exchange.
You was a gift to us, girl. You was a gift. You came at a time we needed you. It's like, shit, just everything happened for a reason. All those elements made us super powerful, man. You was there. You had something to do with that engine starting. That's big. You know what I mean?
You know, I always say that I was raised by Wu-Tang, but I get to really show people this is the Wu-Tang that I know.
Right, exactly.
Right?
Everybody don't know that. Everybody can't say they know that one.
Only I have this relationship with you guys. And for me, the gift is not really my... To me, the gift is to the world and to say, you don't know these men like I do.
Exactly.
You don't know what they meant to me. Being a fan of the music is one thing, but... walking, like Ray, for me, walking through the world, knowing that you have my back is like, I never had that, you know? And that's just, I'm so grateful. It's so powerful for me. And I got to really tell people, so this is why I would say that I was raised by Wu-Tang. And of all the hundreds and thousands of people I saw swarm around them, even really, really early when everybody knew they were going to be famous, they were still like, come here, Soph. Like, this is Sophia. We're just going to tuck him in our pockets.
Yo, listen, yo, trust me, everything you feel, I feel the same way, like, and I just think that, you know, God had a special place for all of us and he put us together for a reason and you were a part of this situation and you helped us so many ways and I gotta thank you a thousand more times again. But all this was in the plans though. You were supposed to do what you're doing. This is what you're doing and now you're telling your story in the greatest way. It must be told. This is a part of our history. You're going to do good with this, girl.
I'm so grateful that you see it this way.
I've been seeing it this way. So come on. You was like the sister that the clan never had. You know what I mean? Like certain people come in our lives for reasons, and it's like, we know who's with us and we know who's not with us. And you know, for us, our history. Oh my God, it's like you was there, so. I'm glad that you're making this memoir be what it is because people need to see this shit. This is very important to what we created. I'm happy for you. Now stop crying because you're going to make me cry now. Stop.
Thank yous. To my father, Bomchik Chang, rest in peace, and my mother, Tongsuk Chang, who always allowed me to chase my dreams, who taught me to love and fight and endure everything with grace, panache, and a profound joie de vivre. My brother, Hee-Suk Chang, who has made me laugh heartily and guided me with his unearthly wisdom from the day I was born, and whose editing of just the first 2 pages of the manuscript changed the bones of it. My son, Jinlong, the golden dragon, and my daughter, Jen Hong, the straight sword that cuts through fire, for being the inspiration and motivation behind everything I do. I love you so much, angels. The father of my children, Shi Yan Ming, who taught me the greatest spiritual lessons of my life and helped turn my body into a temple. My uncle, Yunshik Chang, rest in peace, who filled in the blanks about my father, who had already passed when I started writing. My mentor, Michael Austin, who has advised me with love, wisdom, and compassion in all matters personal and professional for over 30 years. My executive producer, godfather of my children, and one of my closest friends, the RZA, who has supported me unfailingly for 26 years. The Wu-Tang Clan, who claimed me, saw me, protected me, and loved me in a way I'd never known. Hello Sunshine, who believed in my story. Audible, who helped bring my story to life. Janklo Nesbitt, who fought for what I believed in. My editors, Jessica Almond Galland, Charlotte Coe, and Katie Salisbury, for pushing me to be a better storyteller. My readers, Darnell Moore, Elizabeth Mendez Berry, Hua Shu, Joan Morgan, Kevin Brineal, Casey Lehman, Marcel Karp, Michael Austin, Michelle C., Maria Ma, Tiffany Liao, and Treva Lindsay, who took the time out of their busy schedules to read the manuscript and love me enough to be honest with me. Michelle C., my closest friend, who helped me shape the story, who's my home away from home, and is there for me every day to talk me through the good and the bad. Danielle Belton, who never stopped telling me how amazing my story was and uplifts me in every way she can. Chris Lighty, for being my Rock of Gibraltar. I wish you were here. I hope you're proud. My motherfucking village, you know who you are, for being my pillars, my mirrors, and my sounding boards. To my friends who lent their voices to my memoir, the RZA, the GZA, Method Man, Ghostface Killah, Raekwon the Chef, who kicked it all off, Inspector Deck, Redman, Q-Tip, Jarobi, Ali Shaheed Muhammad, Raphael Sadiq, Joey Badass, G Herbo, John Leguizamo, Jim Jarmusch, Michael Mann, John Woo, Michael Austin, Sylvia Roan, Joan Morgan, Maria Ma, and my family, my mother, my brother, and my children. Thank you all. We're gonna win a fucking Grammy. And if we don't, I'm gonna pull an ODB and run up on that stage and snatch it from whoever they're giving it to, because no one deserves this more than we do.
This has been an Audible original by Hello Sunshine production of The Baddest Bitch in the Room, written and narrated by Sophia Chang. Executive produced by Charlotte Coe and associate produced by Gretchen Schreiber for Hello Sunshine. Executive produced by Sophia Chang. Executive produced by David Bloom, Mike Charzik, and Keith O'Connell for Audible. Editorial produced by Jessica Almond-Gallen, with additional editorial support from Katie Salisbury. Project managed by Sophia Chang. Produced by Kat Lambricks. Recorded by Seda Espy Proctor, Sophia Chang, Diana Cha, Billy Hall, and Sarah Pagluica. Edited by Sarah Pagluica and Diana Cha. Sound design by Diana Cha. Music and score composed by DJ Muggs. Organized Noise Productions, FKI First, and Diana Cha. Scratches by DJ Scratch. Music clearances by Deborah Manis Gardner / DMG Clearances Incorporated. And now, starring in order of appearance, Method Man, Tong Suk Chang, Hee-Suk Chang, Q-Tip, Jarobi, Redman, Ali Shahi Muhammad, RZA, Raekwon the Chef, Inspector Deck, Ghostface Killah, GZA, Joan Morgan, Maria Ma, John Leguizamo, John Woo, Jim Jarmusch, Michael Austin, Michael Mann, Raphael Sadiq, Jian Hong Shi, G Herbo, Jin Long Shi, Joey Badass. Credits read by me, Dead. Hey, copyright 2019, Sophia Chang. Sound recording, copyright 2019. Be Sunshine, LLC, DBA, Hello Sunshine.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.